The Castle by Franz Kafka. Chapter 1. Arrival. It was late evening when Kay arrived. The village lay under deep snow. There was no sign of the castle hill. Fog and darkness surrounded it. Not even the faintest gleam of light suggested the large castle. Kay stood a long time on the wooden bridge that leads from the main road to the village, gazing upward into the seeming emptiness. Then he went looking for a night's lodging. At the inn they were still awake. The landlord had no room available, but, extremely surprised and confused by the latecomer, he was willing to let Kay sleep on a straw mattress in the taproom. Kay agreed to this. A few peasants were still sitting over beer, but he did not want to talk to anyone, got himself a straw mattress from the attic, and lay down by the stove. It was warm. The peasants were quiet. He examined them for a moment with tired eyes, then fell asleep. Yet before long he was awakened. A young man in city clothes, with an actor's face, narrow eyes, thick eyebrows, stood beside him with the landlord. The peasants, too, were still there. A few had turned their chairs around to see and hear better. The young man apologized very politely for having awakened Kay, introduced himself as the son of the castle steward, and said, "This village is castle property. Anybody residing or spending the night here is effectively residing or spending the night at the castle. Nobody may do so without permission from the Count. But you have no such permission, or at least you haven't shown it yet." Kay, who had half risen and smoothed his hair, looked at the people from below and said, "What village have I wandered into? So there is a castle here?" "Why, of course," the young man said slowly, while several peasants here and there shook their heads at Kay, "the castle of Count Westwest." "And one needs permission to spend the night here?" asked Kay, as though he wanted to persuade himself that he hadn't perhaps heard the previous statements in a dream. "Permission is needed," was the reply, and this turned into crude mockery at Kay's expense when the young man, stretching out his arm, asked the landlord and the guests, "Or perhaps permission is not needed?" "Well, then I must go and get myself permission," said Kay, yawning and pushing off the blanket as though he intended to get up. "Oh, yes, but from whom?" asked the young man. "From the Count," said Kay. "There doesn't seem to be any alternative." "Get permission from the Count now, at midnight?" cried the young man, stepping back a pace. "Is that not possible?" Kay asked calmly. "Then why did you wake me up?" The young man now lost his composure. "The manners of a tramp," he cried. "I demand respect for the Count's authorities. I awakened you to inform you that you must leave the Count's domain at once." "Enough of this comedy," said Kay, in a remarkably soft voice, as he lay down and pulled up the blanket. "You are going a little too far, young man, and I shall deal with your conduct tomorrow. The landlord and those gentlemen there will be my witnesses, should I even need witnesses. Besides, be advised that I am the land surveyor sent for by the Count. My assistants and the equipment are coming tomorrow by carriage. I didn't want to deprive myself of a long walk through the snow, but unfortunately lost my way a few times, which is why I arrived so late. That it was too late then to report to the castle is something that was already apparent to me without the benefit of your instructions. That's also the reason why I decided to content myself with these lodgings, where you have been so impolite, to put it mildly, as to disturb me. I have nothing further to add to that statement. Good night, gentlemen." And Kay turned toward the stove. "Land surveyor?" he heard someone asking hesitantly behind his back, and then everyone was silent. But the young man soon regained his composure and said to the landlord softly enough to suggest concern for Kay's sleep, yet loudly enough to be audible to him, "I shall inquire by telephone." So there was even a telephone in this village inn. They were certainly well equipped. True, certain details took Kay by surprise, but on the whole everything was as expected. As it turned out, the telephone hung from the wall almost directly above his head. In his sleepiness he had overlooked it. If the young man had to use the telephone, then even with the best intentions he could not avoid disturbing Kay's sleep. It was simply a matter of deciding whether or not to let him use the telephone. Kay decided to allow it. But then, of course, it no longer made sense to pretend he was asleep, so he turned over on his back again. He watched the peasants gathering timidly and conferring. The arrival of a land surveyor was no trifling matter. The door to the kitchen had opened. Filling the doorway was the mighty figure of the landlady. The landlord approached her on tiptoes in order to report to her. Then the telephone conversation began. The steward was asleep, but a sub-steward, one of the sub-stewards, a Mr. Fritz, was there. The young man, who introduced himself as Schwarzer, said that he had found K, a man in his 30s, rather shabby-looking, sleeping quietly on a straw mattress, with a tiny rucksack for a pillow and a knobby walking stick within reach. Well, he had, of course, suspected him, and since the landlord had obviously neglected his duty, it was his, Schwarzer's, duty to investigate the matter. K's response on being awakened, questioned, and duly threatened with expulsion from the Count's domain had been most ungracious, but perhaps not unjustifiably so, as had finally become evident, for he claimed to be a land surveyor summoned by the Count. He was duty-bound to check this claim, if only as a formality, and so Schwarzer was asking Mr. Fritz to inquire at the central office whether a land surveyor of that sort was really expected, and to telephone immediately with the answer. Then there was silence. Fritz made his inquiries over there while everyone here waited for the answer. K stayed where he was, did not even turn around, seemed completely indifferent, stared into space. With its mixture of malice and caution, Schwarzer's story gave him a sense of the quasi-diplomatic training that even lowly people at the castle, such as Schwarzer, could draw on so freely. Nor did they show any lack of diligence there. The central office had a night service. And obviously answered very quickly, for Fritz was already on the line again. Yet it seemed to be a brief message, since Schwarzer immediately threw down the receiver in a rage. "Just as I said," he shouted, "no trace of a land surveyor, only a liar and a common tramp, and probably worse still." For a moment, Kay thought that everybody, Schwarzer, the peasants, the landlord and landlady, was about to jump on him, and he crawled all the way under the blanket to escape at least the first assault, when, he was slowly stretching his head back out, the telephone rang again, especially loud, it seemed to Kay. Although it was unlikely that this call also concerned Kay, everyone froze, and Schwarzer came back to the telephone. After listening to a fairly long explanation, he said softly, "So, it's a mistake? Well, this is most unpleasant. The department head himself telephoned? Odd. Very odd. And how am I supposed to explain this to the land surveyor?" Kay listened intently. So the castle had appointed him land surveyor. On one hand, this was unfavourable, for it showed that the castle had all necessary information about him, had assessed the opposing forces, and was taking up the struggle with a smile. On the other hand, it was favourable, for it proved to his mind that they underestimated him, and that he would enjoy greater freedom than he could have hoped for at the beginning. And if they thought they could keep him terrified all the time simply by acknowledging his surveyorship, though this was certainly a superior move on their part, then they were mistaken, for he felt only a slight shudder. That was all. After waving aside Schwarzer, who was timidly approaching, Kay rejected their insistent pleas that he move into the landlord's room, accepted only a nightcap from the landlord and a washbasin with soap and towel from the landlady, and did not even have to request that the room be cleared, for all rushed to the door, averting their faces so that he wouldn't recognize them tomorrow. Then the lamp was extinguished, and he finally had some peace. He slept soundly until morning, only briefly disturbed once or twice by scurrying rats. After breakfast, which the landlord said would be covered by the castle, along with Kay's full board, he wanted to go immediately to the village. Recalling the landlord's conduct yesterday, Kay spoke to him only when strictly necessary. But since the landlord kept circling him in a silent plea, Kay took pity on him and let him sit down for a moment beside him. "I still haven't met the Count," said Kay. "They say he pays good money for good work. Is that so? Anybody travelling as far from his wife and child as I am wants to have something to take home with him." "The gentleman need have no worries in that regard. One doesn't hear any complaints about bad pay here." "Well," said Kay, "I am not at all shy and am quite capable of saying what I think, even to a count, though it is naturally far better if one can remain on friendly terms with those gentlemen." The landlord sat opposite Kay on the edge of the window seat, not daring to sit more comfortably and keeping his large, anxious brown eyes fixed on Kay. At first he had thrust himself on Kay, but now it seemed as if he wanted to run away. Was he afraid of being questioned about the Count? Was he afraid that the gentleman whom he saw in Kay was unreliable? Kay had to distract him. He looked at the clock and said, "Well, my assistants will be here soon. Can you put them up?" "Oh, certainly, sir," he said. "But won't they be staying with you at the castle?" Was he parting that easily and that gladly with his guests, especially Kay, whom he was quite determined to transfer to the castle? "Well, that hasn't been settled," said Kay. "First I must find out what kind of work they have for me. For instance, if I'm to work down here, then it would make more sense for me to live here, too. and I fear that the life up there at the castle wouldn't appeal to me. I want to be free at all times. You don't know the castle, the landlord said softly. Of course, said Kay, one shouldn't judge matters too hastily. All I can say about the castle for now is that they know how to choose the right land surveyor. There might be other advantages there, too. And he stood up in order to release the landlord, who kept anxiously biting his lips, from his presence. It certainly wasn't easy to win the confidence of this man. On the way out, Kay observed on the wall a dark portrait in a dark frame. He had already noticed it from his bed, but unable to discern any details from that distance, he had thought that the actual picture had been taken from the frame, and only the dark backing was to be seen. But it was indeed a picture, as now became evident, the half-length portrait of a man around 50. He held his head so low over his chest that one barely saw his eyes. The drooping seemed to be caused by the high, ponderous forehead and the powerful, crooked nose. His beard, pressed in at the chin owing to the position of his head, jutted out farther below. His left hand was spread out in his thick hair, but could no longer support his head. "Who is that?" asked Kay. "The Count?" Kay stood before the picture and did not even turn to glance at the landlord. "No," said the landlord, "the steward." "They do have a handsome steward at the castle, that's for sure," said Kay. "What a pity his son turned out so badly." "No," said the landlord, drawing Kay down and whispering in his ear. "Schwarzer exaggerated yesterday. His father is only a sub-steward, and one of the lowest at that." Just then the landlord seemed like a child to Kay. "The rascal," said Kay, laughing. But the landlord said, without laughing, "Even his father is powerful." "Come on," said Kay, "you consider everyone powerful. Me too, perhaps?" "No," he said timidly but gravely, "I do not consider you powerful." "Well, you're very observant, then," said Kay, "for, speaking in confidence now, I'm really not powerful at all. And so I probably have no less respect for those with power than you do, only I'm not as honest as you are and don't always care to admit it." Kay tapped the landlord on the cheek in order to comfort him and to gain his affection. And now he even gave a little smile. He was really a boy with his soft, almost beardless face. How had he come by his stout, older wife, whom one could see through a small window bustling about with her elbows sticking out? Yet Kay did not want to question him any further and risk chasing away the smile he had finally elicited, so he merely signalled to him to open the door and stepped out into the beautiful winter morning. Now he saw the castle above, sharply outlined in the clear air and made even sharper by the snow, which traced each shape and lay everywhere in a thin layer. Besides, there seemed to be a great deal less snow up on the hill than here in the village, where it was no less difficult for Kay to make headway than it had been yesterday on the main road. Here the snow rose to the cottage windows, only to weigh down on the low roofs, whereas on the hill everything soared up free and light, or at least seemed to from here. On the whole, the castle, as it appeared from this distance, corresponded to Kay's expectations. It was neither an old knight's fortress nor a magnificent new edifice, but a large complex, made up of a few two-story buildings and many lower, tightly packed ones. Had one not known that this was a castle, one could have taken it for a small town. Kay saw only one tower, whether it belonged to a dwelling or a church was impossible to tell. Swarms of crows circled round it. Keeping his eyes fixed upon the castle, Kay went ahead. Nothing else mattered to him. But as he came closer, he was disappointed in the castle. It was only a rather miserable little town, pieced together from village houses, distinctive only because everything was perhaps built of stone, but the paint had long since flaked off, and the stone seemed to be crumbling. Fleetingly, Kay recalled his old hometown. It was scarcely inferior to this so-called castle. If Kay had merely wanted to visit it, all that wandering would have been in vain, and it would have made more sense for him to visit his old homeland again, where he had not been in such a long time. And in thought, he compared the church tower in his homeland with the tower up there. The church tower, tapering decisively, without hesitation, straight away toward the top, capped by a wide roof with red tiles, was an earthly building. What else can we build? But with a higher goal than the low jumble of houses, and with a clearer expression than that of the dull workday. The tower up here, it was the only one in sight, the tower of a residence, as now became evident, possibly of the main castle, was a monotonous round building, in part mercifully hidden by ivy, with little windows that glinted in the sun. There was something crazy about this, and ending in a kind of terrace whose battlements, uncertain, irregular, brittle, as if drawn by the anxious or careless hand of a child, zigzagged into the blue sky. It was as if some melancholy resident, who by rights ought to have kept himself locked up in the most out-of-the-way room in the house, had broken through the roof and stood up in order to show himself to the world. Again Kay stood still, as if he had greater powers of judgment at a standstill. But he was distracted. Behind the village church, beside which he had stopped, it was actually only a chapel with a barn-like annex to accommodate the congregation, was the school. A long, low building, an odd combination of makeshift and ancient features, it lay behind a fenced-in garden, which was now a field of snow. Just then the children came out with their teacher. Bunched about the teacher, the children all had their eyes on him. There was constant chatter from all sides. Kay could not follow their rapid speech. The teacher, a small, narrow-shouldered young man, but also, without thereby seeming ridiculous, quite erect, had fixed his eyes from afar on Kay, who was the only person anywhere around, aside from the teacher's group. As a stranger, Kay was the first to say hello, especially faced with such a domineering little man. "Good day, teacher," he said. All of a sudden the children fell silent. Having this sudden silence before he spoke must have pleased the teacher. "You're taking a look at the castle?" he asked, more gently than Kay had expected, but as though he did not approve of what Kay was doing. "Yes," said Kay. "I'm a stranger here. I only arrived in the village yesterday evening." "You don't like the castle?" the teacher said quickly. "What?" countered Kay, somewhat baffled, but then, rephrasing the question more delicately, he said, "Do I like the castle? What makes you think I don't like it?" "Strangers never do," said the teacher. To avoid giving offence, then, Kay changed the subject and asked, "You must know the Count." "No," said the schoolteacher, and he was about to turn aside, but Kay did not give up and asked again, "So you don't know the Count?" "How could I know him?" the teacher said softly, adding loudly in French, "Keep in mind that there are innocent children present." To Kay, this was sufficient justification for asking, "Teacher, could I call on you? I'll be staying for some time, and already feel a little isolated. I don't belong among the peasants, nor in all likelihood at the castle." "There is no difference between the peasants and the castle," said the teacher. "Maybe so," said Kay, "but that has no effect on my situation. May I call on you?" "I live in Swan Street, at the butcher's." Though this sounded more like an address than an invitation, Kay said, "Very well, I shall come." The schoolteacher nodded and moved on with his little bunch of children, who instantly resumed their shouting. They soon disappeared down a steep side street. But Kay was distracted. The conversation had irritated him. For the first time since coming here, he felt truly tired. At first, the long journey hadn't seemed like much of a strain to him, how he had kept wandering through the days steadily, one step at a time. But the consequences of those exertions had to go and make themselves felt now, at the worst possible time, of course. He felt an irresistible urge to seek out new acquaintances, but each new acquaintance had only increased his weariness. In his present state, if he could force himself to prolong this walk to the castle entrance, that would be more than enough. So he set off again, but it was a long way. The street he had taken, the main street in the village, did not lead to the castle hill. It only went close by, then veered off as if on purpose, and though it didn't lead any farther from the castle, it didn't get any closer either. Kay kept expecting the street to turn at last toward the castle, and it was only in this expectation that he kept going. No doubt out of weariness he was reluctant to leave this street. What amazed him, too, was the length of this village, which wouldn't end. Again and again those tiny little houses and the frost-covered window panes and the snow and not a living soul. Finally he tore himself away from this clinging street. A narrow side street took him in. The snow here was even deeper. Lifting his sinking feet was hard work. He broke out in perspiration, suddenly came to a stop, and could go no farther. Well, he certainly wasn't abandoned. There were peasant cottages right and left. He made a snowball and threw it at a window. The door opened right away, the first door to open on his way through the village, and standing there was an old peasant in a heavy brown fur jacket, head tilted sideways, friendly and weak. "May I join you for a little while?" said Kay. "I'm very tired." He didn't hear anything the old man said, but gratefully accepted the plank being pushed toward him, which immediately rescued him from the snow. And after taking a few steps he stood in the room. A large, dimly lit room. At first, the new arrival from outdoors could not see a thing. Kay stumbled against a washtub. A woman's hand held him back. From one corner came the sound of children crying. From another, smoke billowed, turning the dim light to darkness. Kay remained standing there as if in the clouds. "He must be drunk," someone said. "Who are you?" cried an imperious voice, and then, probably to the old man, "Why did you let him in? Can we let in everything that is slinking through the streets?" "I am the Land Surveyor of the Count," said Kay, trying to justify himself in front of these as yet invisible people. "Ah, it is the Land Surveyor," a woman's voice said, and then there was complete silence. "You know me?" asked Kay. "Of course," the same voice said curtly. Their knowing Kay did not seem to recommend him. Finally, the smoke dispersed a little, and Kay was gradually able to get his bearings. It seemed to be wash day. By the door, clothes were being washed. Yet the smoke had actually come from the left-hand corner, where, in a wooden tub, larger than any Kay had ever seen, it was about the size of two beds, two men were bathing in steaming water. But even more surprising, though one still couldn't make out the exact nature of the surprise, was the right-hand corner. Through a large garret window, the only one in the back wall, came pale snowlight, surely from the courtyard, which lent a lustre as of silk to the dress of a woman who almost lay wearily in a tall armchair set deep in the corner. She held an infant at her breast. A few children were playing around her, peasant children by the looks of them, but she seemed out of place among them, though illness and weariness can make even peasants seem refined. "Sit down," said one of the men, who had a full beard in addition to the moustache over his mouth, which he kept open, snorting, and pointed, a comical sight, with one hand over the rim of the bath at a trunk, splashing warm water all over Kay's face. Seated on the trunk, already dozing off, was the old man who had let Kay in. Kay was glad he could finally sit down. No one was paying the slightest attention to him now. The woman at the washtub, blonde, youthfully ample, sang softly as she worked. The men in the bath stomped their feet and thrashed about. The children tried to approach them, but were repeatedly driven back by great splashes of water, from which not even Kay emerged unscathed. The woman in the armchair lay there as if lifeless, without even glancing down at the infant on her breast, merely gazing vaguely upward. Kay must have spent a long time looking at them, at this unchanging, beautiful, sad picture, but then he must have fallen asleep, for when a loud voice called out to him, he awoke with a start. His head was resting on the shoulder of the old man beside him. The men were finished with the bath, in which the children now romped under the blonde woman's supervision, and stood before him fully clothed. The loud-mouthed man with the full beard turned out to be the slighter of the two. The other one, no taller but with a smaller beard than that of his full-bearded colleague, was a silent, slow-witted man of stout build, with an equally stout face. He kept his head lowered. "Surveyor," he said, "you cannot stay here. Forgive the impoliteness." "I didn't want to stay," said Kay. "I simply wanted a rest. Now that I have had it, I am leaving." "This lack of hospitality may surprise you," said the man, "but there is no custom of hospitality here. We do not need guests." Somewhat refreshed after his sleep, somewhat keener of hearing than before, Kay was glad to hear such frank words. He moved about more freely now, rested his stick here and there, approached the woman in the armchair, and was, incidentally, the biggest in the room. "Certainly," said Kay. "What would you need guests for?" "But every now and then someone is needed, such as me, the Land Surveyor." "I don't know about that," the man said slowly. "If they summoned you, then they probably need you. This may be an exception. But we little people go by the rule. You shouldn't blame us for that." "No, no," said Kay. "I simply want to thank you, you and all the others here." And, to everyone's surprise, Kay turned around almost in one bound and stood before the woman. With tired blue eyes she looked at Kay. A transparent silk kerchief had slipped down to the middle of her forehead. The infant was sleeping at her breast. "Who are you?" asked Kay. Dismissively, it was unclear whether the contempt was meant for Kay or her own answer, she said, "A girl from the castle." All this had taken no more than an instant. Now two men, right and left, seized Kay and pulled him to the door, silently but with full force, as if there were no other means of communication. Something about this pleased the old man, who clapped his hands. The washerwoman laughed over near the children, who suddenly began making noise like mad. Yet Kay soon stood outside on the street. The men watched him from the threshold. It was snowing again, although it now seemed a little brighter outside. The man with the full beard cried impatiently, "Where do you want to go? Here's the way to the castle, this way to the village." Kay did not answer, but turned rather to the other man, who, despite his superiority, struck him as the more congenial of the two. "Who are you? Whom should I thank for the visit?" "I am Master Tanel Azaman," came the reply, "but you needn't thank anybody." "Fine," said Kay. "Perhaps we shall meet again." "I do not think so," said the man. Just then the man with the full beard, raising his arm, cried, "Good day, Artur. Good day, Jeremias." Kay turned around, so other people were showing up on the streets of this village. Coming from the castle were two young men of medium height, both quite slender, in tight-fitting clothes, with very similar dark brown faces and strikingly black goatees. They were going astonishingly fast for the state of these roads, flinging out their slender legs in step. "What's the matter?" cried the man with the full beard. One had to shout to make oneself heard, they were going so fast and did not stop. "Business!" they shouted back, laughing. "Where?" "At the inn." "That's where I'm going," Kay cried all of a sudden, louder than everyone else. He so wanted these two to take him along. Though he did not consider this acquaintanceship all that rewarding, they were good travelling companions and could cheer one up. Yet, though they heard Kay's remark, they simply nodded and were gone. Kay was still standing in the snow. He had no great desire to lift his foot out of the snow, only to sink it back in a little farther on. The Master Tanner and his colleague, satisfied at having finally rid themselves of Kay, slowly pushed their way, eyes still fixed on him, through the barely open door into the house, leaving Kay alone in the blanketing snow. Cause for a slight attack of despair was the thought that came to him. If I were only here by accident, not on purpose. Just then, in the cottage to the left, a tiny window opened. Closed, it had seemed deep blue, perhaps in the reflection from the snow, and so tiny now that it was open that one couldn't see the full face of the onlooker, only the eyes, old brown eyes. "There he is," Kay heard the tremulous voice of a woman saying. "It's the surveyor," a man's voice was speaking. Then the man came to the window and asked, not in an unfriendly way, but as if he wanted everything to be in order on the street in front of his house, "Who are you waiting for?" "For a sleigh to take me," said Kay. "No sleighs come along here," said the man. "No traffic comes through here." "But this is the road that leads to the castle," objected Kay. Even so," said the man rather implacably. "No traffic comes through here." Then the two of them fell silent. But the man was obviously contemplating something, since he still hadn't closed the window, from which smoke was pouring. "A bad road," Kay said to help him out. But all he said was, "Yes, indeed." After a little while, however, he said, "If you like, I will take you on my sleigh." "Oh, please do," said Kay, delighted. "How much do you want?" "Nothing," the man said by way of explanation. Kay was astonished. "You are, after all, the surveyor," said the man, "and you belong to the castle. So where do you want to go?" "To the castle," Kay said quickly. "Then I will not go," the man said at once. "But I belong to the castle," Kay said, repeating the man's own words. "Maybe so," the man said dismissively. "Then take me to the inn," said Kay. "Very well," said the man. "Then I'll be out right away with the sleigh." This did not leave the impression of any great friendliness, but rather of an extremely egotistical, anxious, almost pedantic effort to get Kay away from the street in front of his house. The courtyard gate opened and let out a small sleigh, made for light loads, quite flat, without any seats, pulled by a small, weak horse. And then the man himself, not old, but weak, bent, limping, with a lean, red, congested face, which seemed especially tiny because of the woolen shawl wrapped tightly round his neck. The man was clearly ill, and had obviously only come out to carry Kay away. Kay said something to that effect, but the man shrugged it off. Kay learned only that he was Coachman Gerstecker, and that he had simply chosen this uncomfortable sleigh because it happened to be ready, and it would have taken too long to pull out another one. "Sit down," he said, pointing with his whip to the back of the sleigh. "I shall sit beside you," said Kay.
"I will walk," said Gerstecker.
"But why?" asked Kay.
"I will walk,"
repeated Gerstecker, so shaken by a fit of coughing that he had to brace his feet in the snow and grasp the side of the sleigh with both hands. Without saying another word, Kay sat down in the back of the sleigh. His coughing gradually eased, and they set off. The castle up there, oddly dark already, which Kay had still been hoping to reach today, receded again. Yet as though he still had to be given a cue for this temporary parting, a bell up there rang out cheerfully. A bell that for a moment at least made one's heart tremble as if it were threatened,
for the sound was painful too, with the fulfilment of its uncertain longings. Yet this large bell soon fell silent, and was followed by a faint, monotonous little bell, perhaps still from up there, though perhaps already from the village. This tinkling was better suited to this slow journey and this wretched but implacable coachman. "You there!" Kay cried suddenly. They were already near the church. The inn wasn't far off. Kay could now afford to take a risk. "I'm very surprised you risk driving me around like this on your own responsibility. Are you allowed to?" Gerstecker ignored him and continued walking along quietly beside his little horse. "Hey!" Kay cried. Then, rolling some snow from the sleigh, he threw it at Gerstecker, hitting him right on the ear. Now Gerstecker stopped and turned around. But when Kay saw him standing so close by, the sleigh had slid forward a little, his bent and almost maltreated figure, with the red, lean face and cheeks that were somehow different, one flat, the other sunken, and his rapt, open mouth with only a few scattered teeth, he was obliged to repeat what he had just said out of malice, only this time out of compassion, and to ask Gerstecker whether he might not be punished for conveying Kay. "What do you want?" asked Gerstecker, baffled, but without waiting for further explanation, he called his little horse and they moved on. When they were almost at the inn, Kay could see this from a curve in the road, it was, much to his astonishment, quite dark. Had he been away that long? But it was only about an hour or two by his calculations. He had set out in the morning, and he hadn't needed to eat. And till a moment ago there had been steady daylight, then just now darkness. Short days, he said to himself, as he slid off the sleigh and walked toward the inn. Standing above on the small front steps of the inn, a welcome sight for Kay, was the landlord, raising a lantern and shining it at him. Suddenly remembering the coachman, Kay stopped. Someone coughed in the dark. It was he. Well, he would be seeing him again soon enough. Not until he was on the steps with the landlord, who greeted him deferentially, did he notice the two men, one on either side of the door. He took the lantern from the landlord's hand and shone it at them. These were the men he had already met, whose names had been called out, Artur and Jeremias. They saluted. Thinking of his time in the army, those happy days, he laughed. "Who are you?" he asked, glancing from one to the other. "Your assistants," they answered. "Those are the assistants," said the landlord softly in confirmation. "What?" asked Kay. "You are the old assistants whom I told to join me and am expecting?" They said yes. "It's a good thing," said Kay, after a little while. "It's a good thing that you've come." "By the way," said Kay, after another little while, "you're very late. You've been most negligent." "It was such a long way," said one of the assistants. "A long way," repeated Kay, "but when I met you, you were coming from the castle." "Yes," they said, without further explanation. "Where did you put the instruments?" asked Kay. "We don't have any," they said. "The instruments I entrusted you with," said Kay. "We don't have any," they repeated. "Oh, you're a fine sort," said Kay. "Do you know anything about surveying?" "No," they said. "But if you are my old assistants, then you must know something about it," said Kay. They remained silent. "Well, come along then," said Kay, pushing them ahead into the inn. Chapter 2. Barnabas. They then sat together rather quietly over beer in the taproom, at a small table with Kay in the middle and the assistants on either side. Only one other table was occupied, by peasants, as on the previous evening. "This is difficult," said Kay, comparing their faces as he had often done before. "How am I supposed to distinguish between you? Only your names are different. Otherwise you're as alike as—" He hesitated, then went on involuntarily, "Otherwise you're as alike as snakes." They smiled. "People usually can distinguish quite easily between us," they said in self-defence. "I can believe that," said Kay, "for I witnessed it myself. But I can only see with my eyes, and cannot distinguish between you with them. So I shall treat you as one person and call you both Artur. That's what one of you is called." "You, perhaps?" Kay asked one. "No," he said. "My name is Jeremias." "Fine, it doesn't matter," said Kay. "I shall call you both Artur. When I send Artur somewhere, both of you must go. When I give Artur a task, both of you must do it. The great disadvantage this has for me is that I cannot use you for separate tasks, but the advantage is that the two of you bear undivided responsibility for carrying out all my instructions. How you divide up the work is immaterial to me, so long as you do not try to excuse yourselves by blaming each other. I consider you one person." They thought this over and said, "That would be quite unpleasant for us." "Why, of course," said Kay, "it must indeed be unpleasant for you, but that's how it's going to be." For some time now, Kay had been watching one of the peasants slinking about the table. At last, the peasant came to a decision, approached an assistant, and was about to whisper something in his ear. "Excuse me," said Kay, banging his hand on the table and standing up. "These are my assistants, and we are having a meeting. Nobody has the right to disturb us." "Oh, sorry, sorry," the peasant said anxiously, walking backward toward his companions. "One thing above all else you must keep in mind," said Kay, sitting down again. "You're not to speak to anyone without my permission. I'm a stranger here, and if you are my old assistants, then you are strangers too. We three strangers must stick together. Give me your hands on that." All too eagerly they stretched out their hands. "Drop your paws," he said, "but my order stands. I shall go to bed now and suggest you do likewise. We have lost a full workday and have to start work very early tomorrow. You must get hold of a sleigh for the journey to the castle and have it ready at the door at 6 o'clock. "Fine," said one, but the other broke in. "Well, you say fine, though you know it's impossible." "Be quiet," said Kay. "You're simply trying to show you're different." But now the first one, too, said, "He's right. That's impossible. No strangers are allowed into the castle without permission." "Where must one apply for permission?" "I don't know. At the steward's, perhaps." "Then we shall apply there by telephone. Telephone the steward at once, both of you." They ran to the telephone, obtained a connection. How they jostled each other there. Outwardly they were ridiculously obedient, and inquired whether Kay could go with them tomorrow to the castle. The no of the answer reached Kay at his table, but the answer was more explicit. It went, "Neither tomorrow nor any other time." "I myself shall telephone," said Kay, getting up. While Kay and his assistants had attracted little attention up to now, aside from the incident with the peasant, his last remark attracted general attention. They all stood up with Kay, and though the landlord tried to push them back, they gathered round him in a tight half-circle at the telephone. The majority thought that Kay would get no answer. Kay was obliged to ask them to be quiet. He had no desire to hear their opinion. From the mouthpiece came a humming, the likes of which Kay had never heard on the telephone before. It was as though the humming of countless childlike voices. But it wasn't humming, either. It was singing. The singing of the most distant, of the most utterly distant voices, as though a single, high-pitched yet strong voice had emerged out of this humming in some quite impossible way, and now drummed against one's ears as if demanding to penetrate more deeply into something other than one's wretched hearing. Kay listened without telephoning. With his left arm propped on the telephone stand, he listened thus. He had no idea how long, not until the landlord tugged at his coat, saying that a messenger had come for him. "Go!" shouted Kay, beside himself, perhaps into the telephone, for now someone answered. The following conversation came about. "Oswald here, who's there?" said a severe, arrogant voice with a slight speech defect, for which, it seemed to Kay, the speaker tried to compensate by sounding even more severe. Kay was hesitant to give his name. Against the telephone he was defenceless. The person could shout him down, lay down the mouthpiece, and Kay would have blocked a path that was perhaps not insignificant. This book is continued on Disc 2.